Wars are fought not only on the battlefield. They are also fought in people's minds. Public opinion matters. In democracies, it shapes the political room for maneuver. German leaders know that. The Kremlin knows it too. In the last episode, you heard how Russia staged its invasion of Lithuania as a humanitarian mission. Now the blue team wants to turn the tables and regain control of the narrative. It launches a major public information campaign titled Russia, a threat to world peace.
It's about making people in this country understand the threat posed by Russia. On the one hand, this is meant as a wake-up call to make the public understand the seriousness of the situation. But at the same time, we do not want to cause panic. We have to strike the right tone.
This was the government spokesperson. The news items you're about to hear were generated with artificial intelligence.
German Chancellor Peter Tauber has described Russia as a threat to world peace. In an interview with the Evening News, Tauber said, Moscow's objective was to undermine Europe's post-war security order.
I have a broad public information campaign in mind. Large-scale posters at bus stops and in public squares. And of course, television, radio, and obviously, social media.
The German government has released an intelligence assessment on the events in Lithuania, identifying Russia as the aggressor. According to the report, the so-called humanitarian corridor served as a pretext for an illegal invasion. German intelligence agencies, together with allied partners, presented satellite imagery and intercepted communications as evidence.
Intelligence, by definition, is usually kept secret. But sometimes governments choose to make it public. Even before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, NATO deliberately released intelligence about Russian troop movements and invasion plans to undermine the Kremlin's narrative and to show the public what was actually going on. In the war game, the blue team now does exactly that. It doesn't change the facts that Russia has created on the ground. But from the blue team's perspective, at least the public should be left in no doubt about one thing. Who is attacking and who is defending? My name is Carolina Drüten. I am the international security correspondent at the German media outlet Welt. This is Ernstfall. What if Russia attacks NATO inside a German war game? Episode 5. Moment of Truth. The campaign you just heard is the blue team's attempt to regain control of the narrative. By this point, it has fallen behind, and not just in the information space. A quick recap. It is still October 2026. Russia has invaded Lithuania and established a military corridor. But it is presenting that operation to the world as a humanitarian mission, complete with a carefully staged aid convoy. The blue team responded with tough economic sanctions, an attempt to stop Russia's shadow fleet in the Baltic Sea, and a declaration of a state of tension. Conscription in Germany is back. Reservists are being called up, among other things, to help protect critical infrastructure. But the alliance's strongest instrument is still not being used: NATO's Article 5. The United States remain hesitant. Germany and its European allies are now having to respond without clear American backing, while Moscow tries to exploit every division it can find. Russia has also countered NATO's move in the Baltic Sea by sending warships to escort its shadow fleet. Any inspection now risks turning into a direct military confrontation. Inside the blue team, the debate has become more fundamental. How far is Germany prepared to go if Article 5 is never invoked? Several options are on the table. One is Article 42.7, the European Union's Mutual Assistance Clause. At the same time, NATO Secretary General is trying to activate the alliance's regional defense plans without formally invoking Article 5. Whether that succeeds remains uncertain. Meanwhile, the Red Team is focusing on one thing: territory. Russia wants to consolidate its corridor in Lithuania. The troops begin digging in.
Now, the follow-on forces are essentially coming out of their staging areas in Russia. In total, we have assembled four armies, and we are sending in the next wave of troops, also equipped with heavy Prana equipment, and are now consolidating individual villages and roads, fortifying them with additional layered defensive positions.
Russia's defenses are built up layer by layer. Troops dig in, trenches are dug, new minefields are laid, concrete bunkers go up, artillery is moved into position, tanks are dug in, air and missile defenses are deployed. In short, Russia is turning the corridor into a fortified military position, one that cannot easily be retaken. Any counteroffensive would now come at a much higher cost. Publicly, Moscow justifies all of this as a response to what it calls Lithuanian aggression. Even so, the Russian military chief is not convinced these measures would be enough if NATO ultimately decided to respond as an alliance.
The key question for me, purely on a military level, is actually how well we can sustain this air defense bubble long term against potentially attacking NATO jets, for instance.
They'd essentially have to attack Russia now.
Exactly. So the burden of escalation now rests with NATO.
That's an extremely difficult decision, one that could ultimately lead to many deaths and would completely divide NATO. It's almost unimaginable.
If NATO, including the United States, were to try to retake the corridor by force, the Red Team still has one final step in reserve. They never confront the Blue Team openly with that during the war game, but it is clearly part of the thinking. Nuclear threats.
And then the next option would be to signal to NATO and the German federal government that we would also be quite prepared to potentially employ nuclear weapons, and to signal this by activating some of our Iskander-M missile units in Kaliningrad and also in Belarus, and to inform the Americans accordingly. Are they prepared to defend the Baltics in an emergency, also at the nuclear level? I find that hard to imagine.
A quick reality check. What the Red Team is planning follows a familiar pattern. Throughout the war in Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin repeatedly resorted to nuclear threats, especially when Russia faced military setbacks. This speech is from September 2022. Putin declared that Russia would use all available means to defend itself and its people. This is not a bluff, he said. A few days later, Russia formally annexed four Ukrainian regions. The implication was clear. Any attempt to retake those occupied territories would be portrayed as an attack on Russia itself. Since then, Russia has significantly broadened its nuclear doctrine. In the past, nuclear weapons were reserved for situations in which the survival of the Russian state was at stake. Today, Moscow also refers to threats against its sovereignty or territorial integrity, and those are deliberately elastic terms. Another important change: if a non-nuclear state such as Ukraine attacks Russia with the support of a nuclear power, like the United States, Britain or France, Moscow now says it may treat that as a joint attack. In Russia's view, that, too, could justify the use of nuclear weapons. The aim is to deter the West from providing further military support to Ukraine. Back in the war game, the Blue Team is informed that Russian forces in Lithuania are expanding and fortifying the military corridor.
This isn't at all about expanding a humanitarian corridor. It's about continuing the aggression. It's about creating facts on the ground and holding on to the territory that's been seized. The question now is how we respond. Strictly speaking, this could justify an attack, but we shouldn't do them that favor. What we should do is make absolutely clear that Russia is now reinforcing its positions and, in effect, redrawing borders by force.
That was the defense minister. The intelligence chief believes the time has come for a military response.
We cannot simply allow Russia to keep seizing territory unchallenged. We now need to establish defensive positions at least.
The Inspector General of the Bundeswehr is weighing in on the matter.
Taking direct military action will be difficult. In essence, we would have to hold our ground there, meaning we do not pull back. We need to maintain our presence. The forces that are deployed there in an observation role cannot withdraw and leave, because otherwise the Russians will continue entrenching themselves, building anti-tank barriers, laying mines, and fortifying the area. At some point, you have to make clear we are staying here, and if you want to push us out, you will have to actively do something about it.
In essence, he is proposing that NATO troops deploy around the corridor and hold the line, preventing Russia from seizing any more Lithuanian territory. The intelligence chief wants to know whether the forces already in place would be enough.
What do we actually have on our side? That's the crucial question.
The Lithuanian side is relatively small, and at this point, we only have 2 or 3 battalions there, and they are responsible for the entire border area.
In other words, the troops currently available to Lithuania and the Bundeswehr are not sufficient to stop the Russians.
But that would mean that one possible response we'd have to consider is reinforcing the German forces that are already stationed in Lithuania. We've said that we're looking into this, that we'd then deploy them there.
The question is, under what framework should those forces be deployed? The Blue Team still wants to avoid acting alone and respond as part of NATO or the European Union. It is still working on an alternative to invoking NATO's collective defense clause. The Inspector General has an idea.
If we want to involve the European Union more strongly, one option could be to use what used to be called a European battle group. Since May 2025, the official term is European Rapid Deployment Capacity. All EU member states contribute forces to it, naval, air, land, and cyber capabilities. It is primarily designed for what is known as Petersberg tasks, but it could at least be offered as a European option in this situation.
The so-called Petersberg tasks define the European Union's traditional range of military missions. Humanitarian operations, evacuations, stabilization missions, monitoring and peacekeeping. But not large-scale territorial defense.
The force itself is limited to a maximum of 5,000 troops, so the Europeans would first have to discuss who is willing to contribute what. By definition, however, it has a more stabilizing role and therefore appears less offensively aggressive. We could deploy it there and, for example, task it with monitoring the corridor from the Lithuanian side, so that things don't get out of hand, roughly speaking. In other words, you would bring in additional forces, but with a mandate from the EU.
The NATO Secretary General, however, would rather avoid the course the Blue Team is now considering, a European solution.
So just for your consideration, to make sure that we don't have a competition here and make sure that everybody is on the same position, that would, I think, send a stronger message than every capital wondering, are we acting under Article 5, under Article 42.7, or under what?
She is working on a plan that would allow NATO to act without formally invoking Article 5. In the previous episode, she proposed activating the alliance's regional defense plans. She has now made the same proposal to the US Secretary of State in an encrypted chat. His reply comes as a surprise.
The US will support activating the defense plans with European forces if NATO allies have consensus. Separately, the Supreme Allied Commander Europe will have heard through US national channels that he is to avoid any action that could involve U.S.-Russian direct kinetic activity.
At first glance, that sounds like Washington is backing the plan. In practice, it means something else. The United States supports activating NATO's defense plans, but only under certain conditions. First, the Europeans have to provide the troops. Second, all NATO allies must agree. And third, the United States want to avoid any direct military confrontation with Russia. Europe cannot implement those plans on its own. It still needs the United States.
Europe still depends on the US for a lot of key capabilities.
Without Washington, modern NATO operations would be extremely difficult. The US provides many capabilities that European allies either lack altogether or possess only in limited numbers and with limited integration. That includes air and missile defense systems, such as Patriot, which protect cities, troops, and critical infrastructure from missiles and cruise missiles. It also includes real-time intelligence and targeting, satellites, drones, and other systems that reveal where an adversary is concentrating forces, where it is attacking, and what it is planning. And finally, there is what the military calls deep precision strikes.
You may want, I'm saying hypothetically, to launch deep precision strikes into Russia. So you need both the capabilities and the unity around doing that. But that may be one of the most effective ways to stop a Russian aggression against NATO in its tracks, if it's already started.
She is referring to the ability to strike high-value military targets deep behind enemy lines. Command posts, ammunition depots, or supply routes inside Russia. In her view, hypothetically speaking, that could be one of the most effective ways to stop a Russian attack on NATO once it is already underway. A quick reality check. Since Washington announced plans to reduce its military capabilities in Europe, European allies have been scrambling to strengthen their own. Air and missile defense, deep precision strike and intelligence are all high on the agenda. But for now, Europe still depends heavily on the US in each of those areas. In the war game, that's where the American government draws the line. It is prepared to keep NATO's command structure in place and to continue providing intelligence. But US troops would not be deployed further east, and American fighter jets would not strike Russian targets. There is another condition, and politically it suits Washington as well. US support depends on consensus among all NATO allies, and there is no guarantee that countries such as Turkey or Slovakia would agree. Formally, the US would not have blocked anything. Politically, however, the responsibility for failure would rest with the Europeans. Then, another idea comes in from Warsaw.
Poland proposes that NATO responds by contesting the Russian claim regarding aid to AD over the so-called humanitarian corridor.
Poland's prime minister argues that Russia should not be allowed to dictate the narrative. Even after the invasion, NATO should make one thing absolutely clear. From the alliance's perspective, Lithuania remains fully protected NATO territory. In other words, NATO would neither recognize the Russian corridor nor accept that Russia controls access to Lithuanian territory or parts of its airspace.
We suggest humanitarian transport planes flying a designated route escorted by combat aircraft.
His proposal is for the alliance to send humanitarian transport aircraft into Lithuania along a predetermined flight path, escorted by NATO fighter jets. Moscow would be informed in advance about both the flights and the route.
Poland is ready, therefore, to contribute escorting forces, provided that the mission is approved collectively by NATO.
Poland says it would be prepared to take part in such a mission, provided it is carried out by NATO as a whole. The proposal is effectively a test. Would Moscow actually enforce its claim by military means, or would it back down? In this scenario, the burden of escalation would lie with Russia, not NATO. The alliance's secretary general picks up the idea. She wants to put it before the allies in the North Atlantic Council. But every hour that passes gives Russian forces more time to reinforce and fortify their corridor in Lithuania. The Blue Team no longer wants to wait. Neither do the Lithuanians, who had long been skeptical of a purely European solution. They invoke Article 42.7 of the EU Treaty, formally requesting assistance from the other member states. No vote is required. Germany responds by committing the European Rapid Deployment Capacity and takes the lead in planning and commanding the mission. The force, which can deploy up to 5,000 troops, has limited military capabilities. It is not designed to push Russian forces back. Its role is to establish a presence and help stabilize the situation. But it is better than nothing. By now, it is late afternoon at Helmut Schmidt University in Hamburg. Through the window of the room where the Blue Team is sitting, you can see a sports field. The sun is shining. A few soldiers jog past. It is not October 2026, as it is in the war game. It is December 1st, 2025. Russia has not invaded Lithuania. There is no crisis meeting at the German Chancellery. But the real German government is well aware of how fragile Europe's security has become. 2 months earlier, Chancellor Friedrich Merz has put it this way. Germany is not at war, but it is not at peace either. In our war game, the teams have been sitting around the table since early that morning. They have spent the day debating, weighing options, making decisions and revising them. 4 rounds later, the simulation is approaching its end. The red team has stayed on course. It has expanded its military corridor and tried to divide NATO, Europe, and Germany. The blue team has prepared the country for crisis while searching for a European response to Russia's aggression, with NATO effectively blocked by the lack of full US support. Later that evening, the North Atlantic Council is due to decide whether to activate NATO's regional defense plans and whether to test Russia's claim to the corridor by implementing the Polish proposal. The two teams, who have spent the entire day in separate rooms, are about to meet. But first, we return to the red team. The three men reflect on the day.
It must be emphasized once more, we have de facto attacked a NATO country without Article 5 having been invoked to date, after nearly 3 days.
Without the Americans?
Without American interference.
That's checkmate, I would say.
From their perspective, Germany acted with remarkable restraint.
Given the gravity of what has happened, these are extremely weak responses, and they are not sufficient to reverse the situation.
That was Arndt Freitag von Loringhofen, who played Russia's foreign minister. Franz Stefan Gadi, in the role of Russia's chief of the general staff, reflects on why.
What I'd find interesting to understand from a decision-making perspective on the opposing side is to what extent this tepid response is actually the result of a certain fear of escalation already being built into the political decision-making process. The key word here being nuclear weapons.
And that is actually very realistic, because fear of escalation has shaped the German government's approach for many years, in every respect, when it comes to Ukraine, to the wider war, and so on. And that dynamic played out here once again.
Then the red team walks down the short corridor that has separated it from the blue team throughout the war game.
Come over here, we've got room.
The men and women who spent the day as adversaries are now sitting around the same table. In wargaming terms, this is known as the after-action review. The red team begins by sharing its assessment.
From the very beginning, we established this corridor while counting on the West taking far too long to respond.
And that's exactly what we achieved.
The blue team wants to know how its decisions were perceived by the other side.
What kind of response was the red team expecting from us? Did we fall short on those expectations? How did you assess our reaction?
That was Roderick Kiesewetter, who played Germany's defense minister.
I asked four times whether the opposing side is aware that we are essentially establishing this corridor here with 12,000 soldiers and relatively rapidly at that, and that this could potentially have led to combat operations here as well.
Throughout the simulation, the Red Team was repeatedly surprised by Germany's restraint. From its perspective, Berlin's response fell well short of what would have been needed to stop the Russian advance. The Blue Team, by contrast, focused on preparing the country for crisis, coordinating with allies, and building political consensus. At every step, it considered how each decision would have been perceived beyond Germany's borders. Peter Tauber, who played the German Chancellor, draws a broader conclusion.
But this leads me to the assumption that we are trapped in our old ways of thinking and unable to adequately counter such a threat. Frankly, we lack the stomach for an escalation. Even our Chief of Defense never suggested that German troops want to fight and win, or that the Germans or the Allies are so good that they will prevail. But even if we had had the German brigade fight, to at least politically signal that the alliance is serious and accepted that it would cost countless lives, who would have survived that politically? That's the question. We simply didn't have the nerve for it. We are so stuck in our old mindsets that we are no match for a Russian chess grandmaster.
This really shows that the initiative lies with the attacker, especially when they're this well prepared and coordinated. And it also showed how we were trapped in our own way of thinking. Coordinate with our allies, avoid kinetic action, wait and see. In that sense, the exercise reflects a certain reality. We do have mental constraints. Our instinct is, don't escalate, reassure the public. We don't have that Churchill moment. In that sense, the war game is also a wake-up call about our own strategic culture, about our mindset, and what happens when it is turned against us.
Christiane Hoffmann believes the Blue Team made one crucial mistake.
I think our problem was that we never defined our objective. We said we needed to get ahead of events. But that's a tactic, not an objective. It wasn't clear whether our objective was to keep Germany out of the war or to retake the corridor and restore Lithuania's sovereignty, whatever the cost.
Now we hear from Irene Mihalic, who played Germany's interior minister.
At what point should we as the Blue Team have acted differently to prevent the corridor from being established in the first place? That's the key question.
But she also raises a broader question. How realistic would such a surprise attack be outside a war game? In the real world, she argues, NATO would almost certainly have detected the movement of 12,000 Russian troops long before they crossed the border.
My sense is that in the real world, someone would have noticed. We would have had the full machinery of government behind us, the Foreign Office, the Interior Ministry, the Chancellery, all with their agencies, advisors, and analysts. They would have given us a much clearer picture of what was happening and probably put us in a very different position to respond.
We knew Russia was demanding a humanitarian corridor through Lithuania. What we might have been able to influence was the cost of creating it. If there was already a realistic possibility that Russia would try to establish such a corridor, and the military experts here can judge that better than I can, we should have moved in with a much stronger troop presence and made even the attempt far more costly.
Gerhard Konrad, who played Germany's intelligence chief, agrees. In his view, the threshold for Allied action would have been reached much earlier.
Based on the initial scenario, the Alliance would already have had grounds to invoke Article 5. NATO territory was under threat from an asymmetric concentration of Russian forces. One thing has to be said very clearly. In this situation, neither NATO nor the European Union would actually have been able to mount an adequate military response, quite simply because the forces weren't there. There just weren't enough troops.
That is a crucial question. How would NATO, and Lithuania in particular, respond during the early stages of a looming escalation? In our simulation, Russian forces established a military corridor within hours. In Lithuania itself, that drew some criticism. We were told that we had underestimated the country's willingness to fight. At the same time, though, one thing is clear. Lithuania cannot defend itself against Russia on its own. It depends on its allies. That is precisely why our war game was never intended to test Lithuania's battlefield tactics. It was designed to test political decision-making in Berlin. Germany is deploying a brigade to Lithuania. And in a real crisis, Berlin would become one of the key political actors. But the Lithuanian perspective is, of course, essential. So, after the German version of our war game was published, my colleague and I traveled to Lithuania. Among others, we spoke to the country's chief of defense, General Raimundas Vaiksnoras, and asked him about our scenario.
Our indicators and warnings of NATO, usually we see much more in advance what is going on.
He says a military buildup would not come out of nowhere. Modern surveillance systems can detect large troop concentrations.
And we also organize our exercise accordingly.
Whenever Russia conducts exercises or moves troops, he says, Lithuania responds with exercises of its own, matching or even exceeding the scale. Military movements along the border are closely mirrored.
We found out that Germans are very hesitant to act if there is no, let's say, American leader who leads the way in NATO. So in this scenario, they failed to take decisive military action, right? Mm-hmm. Is that something that worries you?
What I can say only in this case, so you have.
He also suggests that Germany's political decision-making processes may need to adapt to military realities. But he is quick to add that he has complete confidence in the German brigade.
But what I would say after meetings with the 45th Brigade Commander General.
Not everyone is quite so optimistic. During our reporting trip, we also spoke to Arūnas Kumpis, a Lithuanian drone expert who volunteered to fight in Ukraine. He believes the course of the Veld war game is realistic.
Actually, from my perspective, it was a quite realistic simulation.
The modern battlefield is transparent. Drones can see every movement. According to Kumpis, neither NATO nor the Lithuanian army is prepared for this. And, he says, this alone may be enough to establish control over the Suwalki Gap.
You can control this gap by drones from both sides.
Would a Russian offensive, like the one planned by the Red Team in our war game, actually succeed in the real world? It's a question we've asked ourselves many times over the past months, while preparing the war game, on the day of the exercise itself, and while producing this podcast. The honest answer is, we don't know.
Ultimately, we don't know whether such an operation would actually be successful on the Russian side. Of course, it's possible that the advance would stall, yes, and that there would then be a 48-hour window where perhaps...
Yeah, just like outside Kiev.
Yes, but for that scenario, I had the options of escalating to the nuclear level and saying that any attack from Poland, so to speak, would be met with a nuclear first strike or something like that, in the event that the advance stalls.
But predicting the future was never the point of this war game. The goal was to observe how decisions are made under uncertainty and to identify where Germany's weaknesses lie. We didn't know in advance whether that would work. For us, this war game was an experiment too. We asked ourselves a lot of questions. Is a single day enough to generate meaningful insights? Will the participants truly step into their roles? How much should we script through rules, briefings, and the scenario? And how much should we simply let unfold? And can a tool normally used behind closed doors be opened up in a way that creates genuine journalistic insight? For the Blue Team Chancellor, there is one final question still hanging over our war game.
Finally, let me ask this. What are you going to do with the results?
Yeah, what do we do with the results? At Veld, we've turned them into this podcast and you've hopefully so far enjoyed listening to it. But what does the research community take away from it? We put that question to our war game adjudication, our white cell, Philip Jan Schäfer and Josef Werbowski, who run the German Wargaming Center at Helmut Schmidt University of the German Armed Forces in Hamburg.
What we primarily wanted to examine with this scenario was how decisions are made inside a simulated cabinet. War games are not designed to recreate every aspect of reality. If we had tried to model everything perfectly, we would never have discovered the blind spot we found. The real question here was, how do people respond to an escalation they don't even recognize as an escalation because they've never seen anything like it before?
One finding runs through the entire exercise, and it is something the Blue Team itself eventually recognized. Team Germany spent a long time acting according to its own logic instead of trying to see the situation through the eyes of its opponent.
Now, that doesn't exactly mean that that's how the people in Kremlin think, but simply seeing how an opponent might interpret our actions, how they might comment on them, and what conclusions they could draw can be incredibly valuable. It reminds you that your message may be received very differently from how you intended it.
Philip Jan Schäfer believes this reflects a pattern that is typical of Germany.
The idea that the world should function according to rules-based order is a very German way of thinking. We assume there are rules, ideally rooted in international law. And if there aren't, we still believe we know how the other side will behave because we project our assumptions onto them. In many ways, we're looking at the world through our own lens. A war game can make those blind spots visible.
Seen that way, this war game is not a conclusion. It is a starting point.
That's one of the great strengths of wargaming. It helps us identify where to focus next. Future exercises can build on what we've learned here. They can involve military staffs, more detailed intelligence, and much more complex scenarios. But now we know where to look and where we haven't been looking so far.
Wargaming isn't about having all the answers. It's about asking the right questions. Both Philip and Joe have taken part in countless wargames, which made one final question particularly interesting to us. How did they judge ours?
I'd say it actually exceeded our expectations because the unscripted nature of the exercise revealed things we simply couldn't have anticipated.
War games are a little bit like modern art. They're not necessarily meant to be pretty or make you feel good. They're not Hollywood movies, but they are made to make you think.
The future cannot be predicted. But once again, how realistic was our scenario and the way our simulation unfolded? After the war game, we put that question to many of the participants as well, including former NATO spokesperson Oana Lungescu.
I think the war game scenario is actually pretty accurate to what I think and many, many others, that in a way, Russia could become even more dangerous to NATO after some sort of peace in Ukraine, especially if it's a bad peace, if it's a Ukrainian capitulation, because that will give Russia time and resources to reconstitute much faster and to be emboldened, because if it sees that aggression pays in Ukraine, it will continue pushing until it finds resistance.
She believes Russia is likely to become an even greater threat to NATO once the war in Ukraine ends, especially if it ends on Moscow's terms. That assessment echoes the view of Alexander Gabuyev, who played the Russian president in our war game.
As someone who has always been a committed pacifist, I've gone through quite a long journey myself, and I've come to believe that European rearmament really is an investment in peace. If Europe does not rearm, there is no deterrence. And without deterrence, the Russian leadership starts getting these kind of ideas. There has to be a level of deterrence where both sides meet on equal terms. Only then can you seriously start talking about arms control again.
The moment NATO is forced to defend itself, deterrence has already failed. In our war game, the Blue Team found itself in exactly that position. Russia had already decided to attack. The moment for deterrence had passed. Here is security expert Nico Lange again, whom you met first in episode 3. He observed the exercise in Hamburg from the sidelines.
Yes, that was part of the scenario. Deterrence had already begun to erode. That's why we ended up in this situation in the first place. And that's why we have to ask the question again, what does effective deterrence actually look like?
After the end of the Cold War, Germany dramatically reduced its armed forces, believing Russia no longer posed a serious threat. That assumption proved to be wrong.
You have to let go of any illusion that there's goodwill on the other side. You have to assume the worst. And then you're probably getting close to reality. From the very beginning, you have to make it absolutely clear to the enemy, don't even think about an attack, because the consequences will be severe. And you have to be able to demonstrate that credibly. Increased military presence is a good start, but that presence needs the right capabilities, and it has to make clear, if you take one step further, our long-range weapons will hit you. Don't do it. It won't end well for you.
Before we end, one final thought from Oana Lungescu. She says it has never been more important to think through the scenarios we would rather not imagine.
I think the war game was very realistic, unfortunately, but I think it's good to be prepared for all the scenarios, especially right now when you see that we have to think the unthinkable.
Europe's adversaries and its allies understand one thing above all else, she says.
We in Europe, in Germany, must continue to strengthen our defenses, to strengthen our resilience, our preparedness, because both our adversaries, but also our allies, the United States, only understand strength.
According to her, that is why Germany and Europe must become capable of defending themselves. Not to wage war, but to prevent one. This was the fifth and final episode of Ernstfall. What if Russia attacks NATO? Inside a German war game. Thank you for listening. If you have any questions or remarks, write us an email to wargame@welt.de. That's wargame@welt.de. Script and storytelling, Carolina Drüten and Antonia Beckermann. Production and sound design, Marvin Schwarz. Project leads, Antonia Beckermann, Carolina Drüten and Caroline Turzer. Research support, Jan Rosenkranz. Academic guidance, Josef Werbowski and Philipp Jan Schäfer from the German Wargaming Center at Helmut Schmidt University, the Bundeswehr University in Hamburg. Cover design, Dominik Schmidt. Our special thanks go to the participants of the wargame. David McAllister, Jörg Asmussen, Gerhard Konrad, Alexander Gabujew, Franz Stefan Gadi, Christiane Hoffmann, Roderich Kiesewetter, Badwome Kott, Arndt Freitag von Loringhofen, Oana Lungescu, Irene Mihalic, Jeff Radke, Michael Roth, Peter Tauber, Christoph Unger and Eberhard Zorn. We're grateful to the fellow journalists who lent their voices to the English language version of our German participants' quotes. Daniel Dillenboehmer, Stephanie Bolson, Francis Durnley, Henry Donovan, Jacob Eckstein, Philip Fritz, Eric Kirschbaum, Chris Lundy, Nicholas Potter, James Rothwell and Konstantin Schreiber. We would also like to thank the Helmut Schmidt University in Hamburg for providing the venue, as well as Alan Edwards, Marlene Badun, Tobias Graboff, Till Henniges, Karl Hufnagel, Elias Jakob, Thorsten Kodalle, Nico Lange and Wim Ort for their support on site. And Nana Brink, Kai Brinkmann and Nils Lange for their valuable contributions to the conceptual discussions.